Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it's Friday, so it's time for our Week in Review. We just heard from Governor Charlie Baker in the last hour at his daily coronavirus pandemic briefing. So that's where we're going to begin with our analysis. For that briefing, WBUR's Carrie Goldberg listened and provided some commentary, and she decided to stay with us, which I'm pleased about. So hello again, Carrie.
Hello, Tiziana.
Also joining us on the line is Reverend Mariama White Hammond, pastor at the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester, and an activist and organizer. Reverend Mariama, welcome back.
Good to be here.
And we have Tom Nichols. He's a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and at the Harvard Extension School. Tom, it's great to have you with us as well.
Good to be back with you.
And you out there, you know how this works. Pull up a chair to the table and join us. How are you holding up this week? And what were the big themes that struck you, made you feel safer, made you feel worried, or just made you think? We want to hear your thoughts on the week's big stories. Call us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. All right, to turn to our panelists, so really a true kind of update from Governor Baker last hour. Sometimes we get big announcements, and we'll talk about a couple that he made earlier this week later, but I just want to get general reactions to what we heard from him. Tom Nichols, I'll have you start.
My general reaction is what a relief it is to hear a political leader speak in calm, measured tones, lower expectations, tell us to be realistic, refuse to get out on a limb. I was especially pleased when Governor Baker kept saying, look, I know you want a hard and fast answer here, and that's not how these things work, which I thought was the responsible adult answer to that kind of question.
And Reverend Mariama, did we get enough balance from that? I hear what Tom's saying. I had the same reaction. I also found myself thinking, and people are still going to be frustrated that they don't know whether things are reopening on May 4th. What was your reaction to that piece of it?
Yeah, I did wonder if that was going to get clear. I sort of said to myself at the end, I said, well, maybe he's already dropped on us that school is closed, and maybe he thought we just couldn't quite take another big announcement like that this week. So I had a similar reaction to Tom. It was just nice to hear someone who like listens to scientists and makes decisions and doesn't spend time in conjecture. So I thought it was, not necessarily the best news, but overall the kind of steady, measured leadership that we have come to expect, and it's needed.
And Carrie Goldberg, the governor did what he basically always does in these press conferences, which is lead with some information about testing, the amount of personal protective equipment that's been distributed, what our hospital bed capacity is right now. And today he seemed to really be wanting to kind of manage the message and the interpretation of the data. What do you think he wanted to get across?
Yes. So I think he was getting across that our testing is way up, that our hospitals are still doing okay, we still have capacity. And just as Tom and Reverend Mariama were saying, he was saying, look, we are going to be guided by the data. And until we have data that makes very clear that the surge is over and we're well into the downward slope, I cannot promise you that we are going to reopen in the foreseeable future, meaning the very close term future. And so he was both giving us the data on which he's basing the sort of managing of our expectations.
And I did want to ask the three of you before we move to some other Week in Review topics. Again, I did find it quite striking to hear Commissioner of the Department of Public Health, Monica Burrell, come back to the podium after having been diagnosed with the virus 4 weeks ago, and really hearing her talk about what her experience was and how it has affected her approach to her work at the Department of Public Health. Any reactions from any of the three of you on that?
Yeah, I really appreciated that. I feel like it gave, a real human face to part of what this virus has done. I mean, I think one of the big challenges that I've seen with my parishioners this week is often what we're hearing about is the deaths. And so people can get really concerned. I had a younger person with no underlying conditions who was just sort of very anxious. And so I think to see someone who has recovered, but who also is taking it really seriously, I thought that was a really important piece for people who are watching it, people who are itching to sort of get back out there maybe, or people who are panic stricken. I felt like her story gave this good measured in between reality check. And I appreciated the governor, the human edge that he's shown multiple times during these press conferences of being clearly glad that she was able to be back. So I thought that was important.
And Tom Nichols, I cannot resist. Towards the end of her comments, she very clearly stated that you should speak to a healthcare provider before pursuing any treatments if you have symptoms or are ill or are concerned. Did Monica Burrell troll the president of the United States during the press conference at 2 o'clock today?
You know, I don't think it's, there were two things I noticed about this. First, I think she gave us a good reminder that a lot of people needed, which is that if you get sick from this, you're going to get really sick. You're not just going to be down with the flu for 5 days with some chicken soup. That, you know, this is like a serious thing, and you can get really, really sick from it even when you recover, and what could have long-term effects. So I was really glad that she did that. As for trolling the president, you know, are we finally in a place where telling people not to drink bleach is trolling the president? Because
okay, that's a good point.
You know, I'm sorry, but you know, there were already some of the president's let's say defenders or explainers began the day by saying, oh, come on, nobody would seriously think about, you know, doing something this stupid. Well, just a moment ago, one of the public information officials in Maryland in Governor Hogan's office, and a reminder that Governor Hogan is a Republican. This is not, you know, Andrew Cuomo or Gavin Newsom trying to score political points. Governor Hogan's office pointed out that the emergency line in Maryland has already had 100 calls about whether this is a bad idea. So
yeah, I want to actually hear this sound. Yeah, it is important. And so it's a long cut, but I think it's really important that we play what the president said last night in his entirety, since we find ourselves, since I took us here on this subject. So here is the president.
Supposing we hit the body with a tremendous, whether it's ultraviolet or just very powerful light. And I think you said that hasn't been checked, but you're going to test it. And then I said, supposing you brought the light inside the body, which you can do either through the skin or in some other way. And I think you said you're going to test that, too. Sounds interesting.
We'll get the right folks who could.
Right. And then I see the disinfectant where it knocks it out in a minute, 1 minute. And is there a way we can do something like that by injection inside or almost a cleaning? Because you see it gets on the lungs and it does a tremendous number of lungs, so it'd be interesting to check that. So that you're going to have to use medical doctors with. But it sounds interesting to me. So we'll see. But the whole concept of the light, the way it kills it in 1 minute, that's pretty powerful.
Now, Kerry Goldberg, you're a healthcare reporter. You're the editor of Common Health. And early on in this pandemic, you often sat with me in the studio when we were doing call-ins where people who were listeners could call into doctors. And we did get questions during that time, both about ultraviolet light and whether it was a possible treatment for the virus, and about the power of different kinds of disinfectants externally. So I just want to be really clear, because I do want to be fair to the president. The things that he is talking about there are not scientific studies going on right now. This is the president riffing off of other things he's heard. Is that correct?
Yes, some people have called it musing. I mean, all I can tell you is that medical Twitter is packed today with every single kind of medical expert saying, I am this kind of expert, I am that kind of expert. Do not drink bleach. Do not inject disinfectant into your body. It's just, I don't even have words for it. But I do have Commissioner Monica Burrell's words. She said, we may be hearing about all kinds of unproven treatments and some may be dangerous. Please go to trusted sources like the CDC. So to get back to your original question, she was absolutely trolling the president. She was saying, don't listen to him.
All right, Reverend Mariamba, before I turn to calls, is there anything you want to add to this piece of the conversation? I'm going to move us on to other things after this, but I hadn't given you a chance.
Well, you know, I have to say, when I heard, I don't watch the press conferences. I need to manage. Yeah, I just need to manage my the things I take in at this point. And when I heard that, I was flabbergasted. I'm not even sure what to say.
I will say that the president just this afternoon, one of our producers, Jamie Bologna, gave me this over one of our shared screens. Just this afternoon, the president said that he was being sarcastic. He said, I was asking a very sarcastic question to the reporters in the room about disinfectant on the inside. So the president has stepped it back and said that he was being sarcastic, but also part of the reason that I wanted to play the full minute of his sound so listeners could judge that for themselves. All right, Tom, go ahead, and then I'll go to calls.
I was going
to
say, but he claimed to be sarcastic. I don't think anybody believes that, but then repeated it. He said, I was, you know, being sarcastic, but you know, and in the very same statement this afternoon, both disavowed it and then said it again, because of course, one of the things about the president is he can never admit making a mistake, and he is not going. Just yesterday, he said, I'm not backing off of hydroxychloroquine, even though he has stopped talking about it. I mean, no matter what you say, there's like an oppositional defiance disorder here that when you tell him not to do something, he does it again just to show you that he can. And he did it again today. So, you know, this isn't going to go away. And I can only, unlike the Reverend, I watch all the pressers out of a sense of duty, even though it's probably not good for me. And I will be fascinated to see how, you know, whether he doubles down again, because that is his reflex on everything.
And just because Jamie's killing it in the remote, giving me quotes, Tom, to your point, the quote is, but it does kill it, and it would kill it on the hands, and that would make things much better. That was done in the form of a sarcastic question to the reporters. All right, let me turn to some callers now. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Jason on the line from Falmouth. Jason, join the conversation.
Yeah, I wanted to note that I'm astounded that the press, it seems like they are deliberately making news by goading the president, who is easily goaded. But I think the press is doing a disservice. And I think they should walk out when they're abused by the president and not cover his outrageous statements. Like you mentioned, sarcasm. Well, you know, we don't have room for sarcasm. People are dying. And let Fox News cover it and let his base watch his outrageous comments. But I think the press should stop looking for the entertainment value in the president being just a clown. That's all. I just wanted to get your feedback on
that,
why they don't walk out.
I appreciate that, Jason. And it just is, yes, Carrie, do it. Yep.
Well, just exactly. I would note, Jason, that there has been a lot of debate about whether mainstream media outlets should cover the president's press conferences directly. And some public radio stations have stopped. I did think in this incident that it actually would have been better not to cover this, because it would be spreading misinformation. Even if he was just being sarcastic, you can figure that a lot of people just listen with a half an ear, and you would be spreading really poor information.
Can I just say I disagree, yeah. And I understand why people say this, but I have been maybe a minority on this, and I disagree about this idea that somehow the media can just stop covering him, and I think it's bad for a couple of reasons. First of all, even if CNN and MSNBC and the networks don't do it, he's going to do it in real time, and if the other media don't cover it, a lot of people will assume that they're trying to hide something or, keep the president away from us. And so if this were still the days when there were three major networks and they could go to Washington and say, look, we're not going to preempt our schedule every single day for a presidential press conference, and there's three of us and you're going to have to deal with this, that might be a different situation. I mean, I think it would be good to just have C-SPAN just carry these things and then, you know, have them covered later. But in the real world of 24/7 and the internet, he's going to get out there and he's going to say things. And I almost think it's, you know, trying to shovel against the tide not to do that. The other thing, and I, by the way, I should remind everybody, I don't speak for the Navy or Harvard or anybody else here. I think it's really important that the American people see him in all his weirdness these days. I mean, I think when the president, first of all, I don't want the media to get into the habit of saying when the president speaks, it's not news, because everything the president of the United States says is policy, whether you like it or not. And that's a bad, you know, habit to get into, to say, well, today we just decided the president's not being serious, and so we decided not to cover him or not to show these press conferences in real time. I think the other thing is that a lot of people, and this is where my, you know, kind of never Trump instincts kick in. I think too many people are able to say, well, I don't watch those things. I'm sure he's fine. No, they should be out there. People should not be able to kind of look away from the fact that the president is basically having an emotional meltdown every day at 5 o'clock. And I think that that is itself a newsworthy thing. One of the ways I've put it is, imagine if Richard Nixon every day during Watergate, 73, 74, said, I'm going to go downstairs, I'm going to talk to the press, no holds barred, for 90 minutes every day at 5 o'clock. That no one would have said, don't cover that. I think President Trump, and I'll just stop with this, I think President Trump is getting us into a very bad habit of not taking the president seriously. And that will come, that is a long-term corrosive effect on our democracy. I think it's terrible. I think he's, you know, putting out misinformation, but you know, for the duration, I think this is just something we're going to have to live with and watch and report on.
Well, I will say to bring this part to a close, as somebody who's both studied and taught leadership, one of the things that I'm learning from these last few weeks is that we are developing an American conversation on leadership again, at the local level, at the state level, at the federal level, what we value and what we don't, what works and what doesn't. And this is more grist for that mill, for sure. Still with us is WBUR's Carrie Goldberg, the Reverend Mariama White Hammond, pastor at the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester, and Professor Tom Nichols of the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island. And of course, you, call us and join the conversation. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK as we explore the week's news and headlines in the coronavirus and beyond. All right, panelists, I actually am going to start with a call. We've got Anna on the line from Truro. Anna, go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I'm wondering if you have advice for those of us who are not suffering from COVID-19, but who are falling through the ever-widening cracks in the health system because we might have new health concerns. So before COVID, I called my local clinic, and they had told me at that time it would be 5 or 6 weeks before I could see anyone for the first time. And most recently, I was invited by Health Connector to update my income to show that I didn't have any, and I was kicked off for some reason because I don't have income. And so I'm in the process of trying to work with MassHealth to get coverage. And I guess my request for advice is, where would I even go, and who would I even attempt to see in my position? I'm guessing I'm not the only person who got this email from Health Connector and updated their information and now is just saying, well, what would I do if I was ill? Who would I see?
And Anna, I just want to be clear. You're saying that you actually got booted off of your health insurance?
Yes. So I was paying $20 a month for my health insurance. And after I updated my information to show that I didn't have an income, the only premiums available to me were $250 or up.
Wow. Wow, Anna, I'm sorry. I wonder if this is a good place to start with Carrie Goldberg, who may have come across similar things in, you know, in your reporting or here at WBUR. Carrie, any thoughts for Anna?
Yes, I mean, I'm so sorry you're going through this. And all I can say is that we've been hearing over and over again from state health officials, including Health and Human Services Commissioner Mary Lou Sutters, that they're doing everything they can to make health insurance enrollment easier for people in this very difficult time, and making eligibility easier and paying people even if they haven't just filled out all their paperwork. And so I think it really makes sense to try to reach the connector, try to reach the, you know, the state health insurance officials who are managing our Medicaid, our mass health, and straighten this out. And they also say, these state officials, that you know, they have way more people taking calls remotely than they normally would. So that's all I can think of to tell you.
Yeah, Anna, we wish you the best of luck on this. I'm glad you called, and I'm sorry that this is the experience you're having. I suspect you're right that you're not the only one. And panelists, that
Tiziana,
really strikes
may I
me.
Add,
oh, yeah, yeah, go.
Yeah. Yeah, let me just add one thing. I mean, one thing that has been very notable in the last day or so is this big emphasis, both from state officials and from Massachusetts hospital leaders, that they've gotten too empty, that basically, you know, they emptied themselves out for COVID-19 patients, and now they're finding that they're getting too few people into their emergency rooms. There's certainly a financial element here. They're just way under capacity. But also they're saying, look, we told you to stay away because we thought we would need all this capacity. Now we think we're at the peak of the surge and we still have, like, you know, a third of our beds empty. And so I think it's a good time, if you think you might need care, to speak to your doctor and find out what to do now, because the rules may have changed.
Perfect, Carrie. And let's pick up on that, because that has been a big emphasis this week. We heard from Dr. Michael Apkin yesterday. He leads Tufts Medical Center in Boston. The governor had he and some other healthcare leaders at the State House. And here's what he had to say about how important hospital visits are down.
We're not seeing the same number of patients coming to our emergency departments with strokes, with heart attacks, with traumas. In fact, we're seeing about half of the activity that we would normally see during the month of April. And we also know that part of it is because people are afraid to come to the hospital. Our concern is that fear is leading to adverse outcomes.
Reverend Mariama, I think of you and your role as a pastor and as somebody who's hearing from community members all the time. Does this resonate with you? And are you hearing fear in the community you serve around getting other kinds of health care?
I completely am. I was dealing with someone earlier this week who was told, in fact, she was first told to go and get a COVID test, got the COVID test. It was negative. And so then she was trying to figure out, well, then why am I having these symptoms? And she was willing to drive hours. She literally drove an hour and a half to find a place that was not an emergency room where she could get the services. So I do think that this is a reality. I think I've talked to two other people who were sort of like, should I go in? Should I not go in? And a lot of their concern was, if I don't have it and I go to the emergency room, will I leave with it? So I think that's definitely a concern. I think the other thing that people might be concerned about, and it connects with what the caller just said, is, you know, folks are feeling not clear about where they are financially. And I have also heard parishioners sort of be not sure they want to do anything that they think might cost them money in the long run. I think there's a number of people who don't know what their healthcare situation is, don't know what their job situation is. And I think that level of uncertainty and the sense that I don't know when I might be able to get another job, so maybe I don't want to do something that's going to incur a lot of expenses at this time. I think that probably both of those situations are helping to cause this problem.
Tom Nichols, I'm going to turn to you in a second, but first, listeners, call on this. Are you feeling other kinds of symptoms and not wanting to get health care? Are you concerned that if you need hospitalization, either you won't be able to afford it or maybe you won't feel safe being in a hospital environment? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We did have some other listeners who had wanted to talk about the president. I'm sorry that I didn't get a chance to take those calls. We're kind of moving on into this direction now, but I appreciate you calling in, and it won't be the last time we talk about leadership and the presidency in this context. Tom Nichols, I did find myself wondering, as Governor Baker was again today talking about the excess capacity that the state planned for in our hospitals, et cetera, is the Commonwealth in some sense becoming a victim of its own success in modeling and planning for a worst case scenario and maybe suppressing people coming in the desire to do that and the way they've communicated about it?
I think all of the states are facing this problem, and it's turning into a political problem, because this is the dilemma that always occurs when preventive measures are successful, that we prepare for the worst, we ask everybody to hunker down, we try to flatten the curve, and then when the hospitals aren't overwhelmed, people start looking at each other and saying, well, this was just a big deal about nothing. No, the whole point was to make sure that the hospitals weren't overwhelmed and that they had the excess capacity if they needed it. And what I'm seeing, you know, again, as a political division is, especially among the people who think that, you know, the states should start opening up faster than they should, is, well, this wasn't a big deal because the hospitals aren't, you know, complete bedlam right now. And so, I think that is part of the problem. I, on a personal level, I'll just say I had a physical exam about a month, 2 months ago, and I wanted to follow up on a few small things. And I've been avoiding going back to my primary care guy because I don't want to burden them. I don't want to be in a medical facility right now, you know, that could be under stress. You know, I feel that very keenly, even as someone who is well insured, relatively healthy, that there are things that I would want to check out. And yet, I'm avoiding interacting with medical facilities. And I would add, one of the things that really struck home with me during the briefing, I have a brother who passed away, just like Elizabeth Warren. I lost a brother in Massachusetts, and he was in the Holyoke Soldiers Home. Now, he didn't die of COVID, but we couldn't get to him. There was that distance where, you know, we didn't get to say goodbye. People couldn't go in. We don't know what's going on. I mean, it is really a stressful thing to even think about being near any kind of medical or care facility because of all of these kind of cascading domino effects that we all start worrying about. So I think that's a perfectly natural fear. And I have a lot of empathy for people who feel it because I'm feeling it myself very keenly.
And Tom, I am so sorry for your loss. I really am.
Thank you. My brother was much older. He was in poor health and, you know, had been in the soldiers' home for a while. But this really added a tremendous amount of stress about is this the natural process of aging? Is he part of this outbreak? You know, it's a very panicky time. And of course, you can't go anywhere near the facility because of these quarantines. And so, you know, it's stressful. It's definitely an added stress, even in a bad time.
I'm going to turn back to a caller here, as I do, to Anna in Truro, who called earlier. Just a little bit of information for you regarding how you might be able to get back on your Mass Health insurance. According to Mass.gov, if MassHealth members or applicants need support or have any questions, they should contact the Customer Service Center. And I just want to give you that phone number. It's 800-841-2900. That's 800-841-2900. And I'm going to give another number, which is the call-in number here for Radio Boston, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Paul is on the line from Hanover. Hey, Paul.
Hey, thanks for the show. I just want to say I've been avoiding seeing a couple of physical issues like tendonitis, carpal tunnel, and now an upper thoracic strain for a couple of weeks because my concern is not so much my own status, but walking into a doctor's office, I go to a community health care center in Quincy, and then what sort of people have been through there are catching, you know, COVID-19, and also my mother recently passed away from COVID-19. So I do have some concern,
Paul,
about it.
How are you doing, Paul, in general?
I mean, it's a sad time for everybody, you know, and with my mother, she was older. She was in a nursing home. So that, you know, this about 50% mortality rate, I think, in nursing homes when COVID-19 gets in there. But, you know, it's just I have some chronic injuries, and I'd like to get them treated, but I'm also, again, I'm very concerned about the potential for infection in like a waiting room, you know?
Yeah. I'm glad you called, Paul, and told us about all of that. Thank you. I want to add one more voice with Paul's. We've got Joan on the line from Wellesley. Joan, go ahead.
Hi. I'm ready to have a shoulder replacement. I had one, and I've had difficulty with it. It became loose, and it needs to be redone, so it's dislocated. And I've been holding on because they called it an elective surgery. And I am dying to get this taken care of because it's very painful. But on the other hand, I'm terrified to be in the hospital. I want to know, you know, were the nurses taking care of the COVID patients? Have they been, has it been 2 weeks or longer, you know? And there's no way to find out that information. And yesterday I found out from another physician that all the COVID patients after they get out of ICU are going to the orthopedic floor. And
all right.
Because,
all right. So that's it. Yeah, so I understand
really
that concern,
afraid.
Joan.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's turn to Carrie Goldberg here. So, Carrie, that is two calls with people expressing genuine and, as Tom Nichols pointed out, and as Reverend Mariama pointed out, understandable concerns about pursuing other kinds of health care right now. What are your thoughts and reactions?
Yes, I completely understand. And Paula, I am so sorry for your loss, too. The first thing that comes to mind is that this is going to really foment the ultimate telemedicine revolution. And so it's incredible what's being done right now remotely. I know you can't do a remote shoulder replacement, Joan, but there are many, many things. For example, even with tendonitis, you know, you might be able to get advice remotely. You might be able to schedule an appointment for when things get better later. And also, Paul, I wouldn't worry about burdening your primary care physician, because we have this very funny bifurcated picture right now where the people who care for the COVID-19 patients are insanely busy and everybody else is kind of relatively idle. You know, there's a lot of unused capacity because there are so many people like you who just don't want to go anywhere near these offices. And so there are a lot of other specialists who are underemployed. So anything that you can possibly do remotely, I would think about, and maybe an appointment for farther out. And I'd also like to address one thing that Tom mentioned, which is that, it's looking like the hospitals didn't get overwhelmed. And so that raises political questions. Well, in fact, if our hospitals hadn't done all the surge planning that they did and all of the redeployment of personnel, our hospitals would be overwhelmed. Our biggest hospitals already have more ICU patients than they could accommodate in a normal time. And it's only because they shifted so many departments into intensive care that they can handle the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of COVID-19 patients who need intensive care. So it really is a success.
Just to be clear, I totally agree with that. My only point was that, unfortunately, that there are people who just won't think about that and for whom that process was invisible. And now they're trying to make this argument that, well, maybe this was all overreaction. It wasn't an overreaction. The fact that we're even able to talk about this in something less than a completely disastrous environment is because we did these things ahead of time.
Right.
And Reverend Mariama White-Hammond, I'm going to turn to you here, and I'm going to confess in advance, it may just be a sentence that doesn't end instead of a real question, because I'm not really sure how to form this into a question. But as I'm listening to this conversation, I cannot help but think of what we have already learned about the fact that people who are already underserved or poorly served by our healthcare system, because they are vulnerable populations or because of systemic racism or socioeconomic disparities, may be even less likely now to be getting other forms of healthcare support. And is this part of the equity picture we need to be talking about?
Oh, yeah. No. So I am excited about the possibility that telehealth could make things better. I was on the phone yesterday with a parishioner who was supposed to have a telehealth visit that wasn't quite going well because he didn't have it would have been much easier if he could have done it on a laptop, but he didn't have a laptop. So I think I'm not saying I'm against these things. What I am saying is that there are still people who don't have the same level of resources to participate in the system. I'm really thankful for the number of people that got involved in the conversation around the potential rationing of care, because the early conversation would have meant that people who have, quote unquote, comorbidities, many of which are at the level that they are at because they do not receive adequate health care, could have been the people denied vents that they needed. And so I think that I'm really thankful that we haven't seen the overwhelm. But I think if we had, I think there's a real strong possibility we'd be having even tougher conversations about who was allowed to die and who was kept alive. I think, I got to talk with the Attorney General recently. I think there's some looking at how do we make sure that workers' comp covers people who are are supermarket workers, people who do not usually get considered as folks that have access to hazard pay or the right kinds of workers' comp. So there are a lot of issues around who is at risk, what kind of care they received before this, how that impacts their health now. And I think there is still a lot of room for a much more robust conversation about these issues.
I'm glad that you talked about that. There is one more thing. I want to make sure we have time for our hubbubs because I know we need Uplift now. So I just want to spend 60 seconds. A reaction from any one of you will work. We did, in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, announce this week that schools are closed through the end of the year. A thought on that or the impact that that is going to have. Any one of you would be welcome.
Maybe a somewhat contrarian take. I'm hoping that one of the things that comes out of this crisis is that the people who think that we were going to transition to, I'm talking about before the pandemic, that, hey, you know, wouldn't it be great to transition to virtual offices and online education and, you know, doing things independently? I teach online courses. I've been involved in things like that for years. But I hope people start to recognize the limitations of that, because it was something that people talked about hypothetically, and they would say, wouldn't that be great? But it's not great. It's something that you do as a coping mechanism, and it's a great way to get education, for example, to people that are in different time zones or who are far away from a traditional campus. But I'm sort of hoping that when all this is over, we kind of dampen down the super high expectations of virtualizing the world, and that we find out that actually we do want to be in classrooms with our students, and that people do need to see each other. Because I mean, in some ways, I think that could be a silver lining, that we can finally end that what I think has always been an irrational enthusiasm about transitioning everything we do to some kind of online or virtualized presence.
All right,
Tiziana, I see
that,
the opposite silver lining from Tom. Yeah, so this is the opposite from Tom, but kind of agreeing, which is that he comes from the experience of higher education. In lower education, in secondary education, in elementary school and high school, there has been virtually nothing in terms of remote learning going on. And so if a kid was recovering from a virus, let's say, and still felt lousy for a couple of days, so couldn't go back to school, but was pretty much functional, there was no way for them to really be able to participate in school at all. And what I'm hoping is that even though I would never, ever want school to be the way it is now, maybe what we're doing now will spur sort of more accommodations to kids who might have chronic conditions or other reasons why they sometimes can't be in school, and they would be able to at least a little bit be participating in school remotely.
All right. Excellent. Thank you, Carrie. So I do want to get to our hubbubs. We're very tight on time, so we're going to do this as a little bit more of a lightning round. But these are the local stories or events that caught our attention this week and brought us some inspiration. So briefly, Reverend Mariama, did you bring a hubbub this week?
I did. I just want to give a shout out to all of the young people who helped us celebrate the 50th anniversary of Earth Day. If you got to see any of those online events, they made me feel like the future is in good hands. So thank you for lifting my spirit. And there's a lot of thinking we need to do about how to address climate change.
Excellent. How about you, Tom Nichols?
My hubbub is, as always, an Ocean State related hubbub, because although, as I point out every time, I am a son of the Commonwealth and born and raised in Massachusetts, I now make my home in Rhode Island, where, you know, it's kind of fashionable in Massachusetts sometimes to zing our neighbors to the south. But here we are in this small, plucky state in between two hotspots in New York and Boston. And yet we're the only state that has done enough testing that we could even remotely consider being in phase one of the national health guidelines. So I want to give a big shout out, you know, to the state of Rhode Island, to the governor here, to the people of Rhode Island that have been pulling together, that I think, you know, we've really been a good example, especially because we're in a pretty tight spot in between two of the biggest outbreaks of the virus right now. So way to go, Rhode Island.
Excellent. So a tip of the hat to Rhode Island. I'm going to keep mine very brief. I just want to take a moment to say Ramadan Mubarak to all our Muslim community members, because today, or technically last night here in the United States, is the first day of Ramadan. We talked about Lent and Passover earlier in the month, and I just want to take a moment to mark this day and send good wishes to all those who are observing it. And Carrie Goldberg, your hubbub, and I think I'll be taking us out on some music once you tell us what it is.
Yes, you will. So this is a kind of a, in case you missed it, WBUR had this so uplifting profile this week of a transport worker at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. So he's the guy who pushes you along in your gurney as you're going from one department to another. And as he's pushing his patients, he sings to help them be more at ease. And so I hope we can just play a little. He has an awesome voice. Can we play a little bit of his tape?
Yeah, I think we'll go out on his tape, actually. So let's hear that.
When you're weary.
An excellent. While that plays in the background, I'm going to say goodbye to our guest, WBUR's Carrie Goldberg. Thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
When and Tom Nichols, a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and the Harvard Extension School. Tom, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
And Reverend Mariama White-Hammond, pastor at the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester and an activist and an organizer. Thanks to you for joining us today as well. So stay tuned. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit of sports. We got somebody moving south. We got a slap on the wrist for a local team. We'll come back and check the score. Stay tuned. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.
I will lay me down.
Joining me now is Radio Boston's Chris Siderick. Chris, are you there?
I am here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, welcome back, Chris. It's so funny. We're all having to manage this blind now. So I'm like, Chris, are you out there?
Someone out there in the dark. I think you're out there.
That's
yeah.
right.
I'm here.
That's right. All right. So, Chris, we have talked about Tom Brady going to Tampa Bay. TB headed to TB. But there is some news regarding a – oh, thank you. You see what I did there? There's some news this week regarding a new Buccaneer teammate, and I kind of can't get my head around it.
Yeah, I don't know if you're in the kind of the same networks as me, but I had a couple of texts on Tuesday that just said Gronk, and so I thought I either had to go to ESPN or TMZ to figure out what was going on. But it turns out former Patriot tight end Rob Gronkowski will be joining Tom Brady in Tampa Bay. I mean, this is Gronkowski coming out of retirement, coming back to play again is something that people have been talking about from the beginning when he walked away, because he was still such a talented guy. I think it's really interesting. I want to play a little cut here. This is from Monday, the day before it came out that he was coming out of retirement. Rob Gronkowski talking with Andy Cohen on Bravo's Watch What Happens Live. Here's what he said.
Andy, you want to know what's so great, man? The day that I retired, within 24 hours, there was already rumors that I was coming out of retirement. I'm feeling good right now. I'm happy where I'm at. And you just
You never know, man.
You never know. I'm not totally done. I like to stay in shape. But I got to get that feeling back.
So right at the end there, he said, I've got to get that feeling back. That's something he's been talking about all along, that he just kind of lost the desire, lost that enthusiasm for the game. So it was interesting to hear him say the day before the news broke that he still was searching for that feeling. I guess Tom Brady must have talked it back into him.
I got to admit, it really, for me, revealed how much I don't understand about how contracts work, because he was retired and yet the Pats traded him. So what?
That's right. Essentially, teams retain player rights when they retire. The idea being you can't retire just because you don't like the team you play for and then sign with somebody else. If you're under contract, you're under contract. So that's what kind of made this really interesting, because in order for this to work, he'd have to come out of retirement and then the Patriots would have to trade his rights for him to play for another team. And on top of that, the NFL Network's Ian Rapoport is reporting that Tom Brady, when he was talking to potential suitors, said, if you bring me in, I want to bring Gronk in as well. Again, that's relying on the Patriots making a deal. So it's interesting that he made that such a big part of his signing somewhere else. But ultimately, it worked out. Patriots traded a 7th-round pick and the rights to Rob Gronkowski for Tampa Bay's 4th-round pick.
Kind of a cheap trade. Why would the Pats do it?
Well, on the surface, it might look that way, but I'd say you got to think of this as basically found money. Rob Gronkowski was not coming back to the Patriots. We talked about, you heard him say he had to get that feeling back. He didn't have the fire for the game. I want to play a little bit of what he told reporters on Wednesday when he was talking about his body and his health and ultimately his decision to come back and play.
It definitely wasn't last year. My body 100% needed a rest.
You know, I played football for whatever, 15 years straight, college, high school, NFL, and I was taking hits, surgeries, everything. My body 100% needed rest. I didn't have that fire underneath me, but I knew I loved the game of football.
So I really feel like there are two things there. The health was totally legit. This is a guy who's been plagued by injuries his entire career, and you could really kind of see it just in the way he moved on the field. It wasn't quite as smooth. He really was kind of struggling and really had to work to play the game and was taking a pounding. And then that fire, that feeling that he talked about, that enthusiasm for the game, I think what he really means there is fun. He wasn't having fun playing here in New England under Bill Belichick the way that he had his entire career up to that point. And ultimately, if you're going to put yourself through that kind of pounding and take that kind of punishment, you've got to enjoy what you're doing, right?
Yeah, okay, fair enough. So before we go to the Red Sox, and I do want to leave a little bit of time with that, you were just talking about the injuries, the way he slowed down, that he was having less fun. But this guy was a great football player, right?
Oh, absolutely. I don't want that to get lost here. You're talking about one of, if not the best tight end to ever play the game. And even when he actually started to decline a little bit, he was still pretty good. I actually really love that our last memory of Rob Gronkowski here in New England. I want to take us back there for a second. So this is his last catch that he made with the Patriots. There's less than 8 minutes left in the fourth quarter of Super Bowl 53. This is against the Rams. It's a 3-3 tie. It had been a defensive struggle the whole game. Nobody could really get the ball moving, and nobody could score points. Patriots have the ball on the Rams, 31-yard line, and here we go.
Second and three. Down the field, and goal! Gronkowski has it at the 2-yard line. It's the same play three times in a row. Edelman over the middle, Gronk on a seam, and the ball is perfectly thrown, and Littleton can't get there. Gronk lays out and catches it. Three plays in a row, the exact same, Jim.
I love that. That's Tony Romo that just exasperated that they're running the same play and it's still working. But if you saw that player, if you have that image in your head, it's Rob Gronkowski flying down the field, laying out a full dive. For a guy who was 6'6", almost 270, he had incredible speed, incredible explosiveness, incredible hands. He could catch balls, you know, an inch off the ground. He could do things that no other guy his size and strength could do. And I think that's why he was one of the fiercest weapons at that position ever. I would say the greatest ever. Some might argue Tony Gonzalez had a longer career, put up better numbers. But in terms of who you feared on the field, it didn't get more fearsome than Rob Gronkowski.
All right, Chris, we've got less than 2 minutes left, and I do want to get to the other major story in Boston sports this week, which is the MLB concluded its investigation into the 2018 Red Sox over allegations that they were using an in-game video feed to steal signs. Very briefly, what was the finding there?
Yeah, so we won't get too deep into it, but basically the MLB found that the Red Sox scheme was not as complicated as the Houston Astros scheme. You remember that? Banging on trash cans and trying to decipher the pitches live. According to MLB, they say one guy, JT Watkins, the video replay system operator for the Sox, was passing information along to players in-game that he pulled off the video feed and supplying that information to the players. But the MLB basically said it didn't go any further than that. So he is suspended without pay for the year, and the Red Sox forfeit a second-round pick. Much, much lighter than Houston's penalty.
All right, and in the last 30 seconds, put the Alex Cora dimension of this in context, given that finding.
Well, this is really a believability question for me, because MLB saying they say Alex Cora knew nothing about it. He shouldn't have known about it. It wasn't his responsibility. I just can't buy that. The guy was a huge part of the Astros scheme in 2017. It at least raises some eyebrows.
Yeah, when you told me, I was like, yeah, right. And I guess I don't mean that about Alex Cora, but it's just hard for me to believe that that at least someone else didn't know what was going on.
Well, and you're the coach. The buck stops here, right? You're the guy in charge.
Yeah. All right, that's Radio Boston's Chris Siderick. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Tiziana.
And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director, with engineering today by Glenn Alexander. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi, and I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.